Welcome to the ISGO podcast with Dr. Dearan O'Leary. My name is Dr. Dervla Collins. I'm a medical oncologist and I'm president of ISGO, the Irish Society of Gynecological Oncology. Our aim is to advocate for patients through improvements in education, training and research. And the purpose of this podcast is to highlight the lived experience of patients undergoing gynecological treatments, combining the evidence with patient stories. We hope this will serve as a support to patients as well as those working in the area. We are very grateful to our sponsors, Breakthrough Cancer Research, Ireland's leading research charity for poor prognosis cancers. Breakthrough Cancer Research supports research all over Ireland in gynecological cancers.
Welcome to episode 2 of the ISGO podcast. In this episode, we talk to Dr. Dervla Collins, consultant medical oncologist, about the evidence behind PARP inhibitors. And then we'll speak to Jenny about her experience on PARP inhibitors and living with ovarian cancer. Dr. Collins, good morning. Thanks so much for joining us this morning. And I just want to say as well, thank you so much for all of the work you do for cancer patients. You're a very inspirational person, so thank you so much. Dr. Collins, what are PARP inhibitors?
Thanks very much, Dearan, for having me. So I suppose PARP inhibitors are a drug that we use in ovarian cancer mainly. We use them in the post-chemotherapy setting. And I suppose and that can be for a number of years. So 2 to 3 years usually in total. Understanding how PARP inhibitors work is you need to understand a little bit about how ovarian cancer has happened and how ovarian cancer, how it develops. So as part of our normal cell division, our cells can make mistakes in their DNA, and these are called mutations. PARP is part of some of the pathways that actually repair those DNA mutations. And in about 50% of ovarian cancers, so in about 50% of patients with that type of cancer, PARP inhibitors can control and maintain the cancer by killing the cells.
Okay. And so it's after the chemotherapy. So they're like a maintenance type treatment?
Exactly. So ovarian cancer, and this is predominantly the high-grade ovarian cancer. So there are other types of ovarian cancer out there. So it is the high-grade ovarian cancer that we're using the PARP inhibitors for. So patients finish their chemotherapy. They've often had their surgery as well during that time. And then in order to keep the cancer in remission, in order to keep it from relapsing or from recurring, we put patients on a PARP inhibitor for a number of years.
Okay. And is it for patients with ovarian cancer with specific gene types? Is it for all patients with all types of ovarian cancer?
So as I suppose as research improves and as we understand more about ovarian cancer, we do know that there are groups of ovarian cancers that do respond much better to the PARP inhibitors. The most well-known one, I suppose, are BRCA mutated ovarian cancers, and this can be inherited, so it can run in families, but actually sometimes the cancer itself has a BRCA mutation that is not part of a person's family history, so it's just within the cancer themselves. So we know that cancers with a BRCA mutation respond the best to PARP inhibitors, but there are about 50% of all the high-grade ovarian cancers that do get some benefit from the PARP inhibitors. And these are other mutations besides the BRCA mutation that actually allow this sensitivity.
It's really fascinating, you know, that the genetic component, not only of what, you know, what you might have inherited, but then the genetics kind of the cancer itself. I don't think there's a lot of public awareness that, you know, that level of detail is going into, you know, cancer research and cancer treatment. So you're getting a very specialised, I suppose, specific type of cancer treatment for the type of cancer you have. The PARP inhibitors, are they a new type of medication or have they been around for very long?
So I suppose some of the earliest trials actually go back to maybe about 10 years ago now, when we first started to see the results of where the PARP inhibitors really worked, which was, you know, in patients who've, you know, responded to chemotherapy, what we call platinum sensitive, but also with the BRCA mutation. But I suppose it's to get to the actual every patient in Ireland, it's only been a number of years that we've had access, maybe 3 or 4 years that we've actually had access
okay.
to the drugs.
So that's like brand new, really, in terms of like the medical world, isn't it? So they are new. Okay, that's exciting, isn't
yeah,
it? Okay.
It is, yeah.
And you were involved kind of in the early research, weren't you? In you were in the Royal Marsden in London at the early days of researching these medications. So you were saying therefore a maintenance treatment, is it important when, you know, say after, for how long after chemotherapy a patient starts these medications?
Yeah, so we usually start them maybe, you know, 4 to 6 weeks after a patient okay. has finished their chemotherapy, giving them an opportunity to recover from the chemotherapy itself before we start. PARP inhibitors have their own side effect profile. They have, they definitely have side effects that can be quite considerable in some patients, and in others can be very well tolerated. It's very difficult to predict, I suppose, in advance, you know, who gets what side effects. And that's, I suppose, where as well, how everybody is so unique and every treatment affects everybody so differently. When we start the PARP inhibitor, most of the side effects actually occur in the first, you know, month or two of actually starting it as the body's adjusting to the treatment. And the most common things that we see are tiredness or lack of energy, but also nausea in those first few weeks. And I would normally prescribe an anti-sickness medicine with my patients in order to try and reduce this. But even if patients still feel sick in the first few weeks, I do try and reassure them that it tends to get better with time. And obviously, the PARP inhibitor maintenance treatment is a considerable length of time. So we are committing a patient to a treatment that has side effects for 2 to 3 years. So managing those side effects becomes really, really important, and trying to maintain patients on the drugs for as long as possible is the priority. And that may at times require some, you know, treatment breaks or holidays, some dose reductions, and even, you know, come down a dose and then go back up a dose. So there's a lot of adaptability according to how patients are getting on with the treatment, how it's affecting their quality of life.
Okay, so yeah, that's an important message that, you know, if there are side effects or the medication needs to be paused for a while or the dose reduced, that's okay, that you can kind of circle back to it again when the time is right.
Exactly. Yeah, that's pretty much normal treatment. I would always tell my patients that when I meet them first, say it is absolutely normal for you not to be on this continuously for the next 2 years. You're going to have time off. You're going to need dose changes. That's normal. It doesn't impact the efficacy or okay. the actual effectiveness of the
yes.
drug itself. The goal is to keep patients on it for as long as possible, especially, you know, for as long as the cancer is in remission, rather than, you know, have a side effect and then have to discontinue the drug. So our goal is try and keep it for as long as possible.
Okay. So the PARP inhibitors are designed for patients who have cancer in remission. Those are the patients who take it. So in terms of efficacy, so what is the goal of this drug? And the most commonly used one is niraparib? Is that the one that everyone goes on? Or
no, so there's two at the moment that we have, olaparib and niraparib. Olaparib is at the moment used more in the BRCA patients, because that's where the clinical trials have shown the most efficacy. And in fact, most of the olaparib studies looked at just BRCA patients alone. And that's the inherited BRCA, but also in the cancer itself. Niraparib looked at all over high-grade ovarian cancer patients. So therefore, I suppose if you don't have the BRCA mutation, you'll often get access to niraparib. Again, as I said, it works in about 50% of patients. About the other 50% of patients, it just doesn't have an impact in keeping the cancer in remission. So the cancer can come back during that that period of time while you're on a PARP inhibitor.
Okay. So the medication, is it a tablet or is it an infusion, or how do patients access it?
Yeah, so it's prescribed from your oncologist, and your oncologist will have a conversation with you before you embark on the treatment about, you know, what its purpose is for, and is for maintaining remission of the cancer and for prolonging that as long as possible. And in some of the studies that we're seeing, you know, cancers that, you know, would often come back in, you know, a few years time, we're seeing that the cancer is not returning for many, many years. And obviously that's a huge impact for patients themselves. Mm-hmm. So I would also, it is a tablet treatment that they take. So some of them are twice daily tablet treatments. Some of them are once just in the morning. So niraparib is once a day, olaparib is twice a day. And sometimes that pays into, you know, or plays into what a patient might want. They may prefer a once daily treatment. We don't have, I suppose, head-to-head comparison difference. We don't know whether one is better than the other. They do work in the same mechanism of action. And of course, research and clinical trials are changing all the time in ovarian cancer. And that's what makes, I suppose, me as an oncologist, makes this such an exciting field to work in, is that new treatments are coming down the line all the time, new combinations. So we're now adding the PARP inhibitors to, I suppose, what we call the anti-angiogenic or the anti-blood vessel medications that we would have used for years, drugs like Avastin or Bevacizumab. So those are now coming together as combination strategies, again, hoping to improve patients' outcome again. So really exciting time to be involved in gynecological cancer research and trials, but also, most importantly, really profound benefits for patients. And we're turning ovarian cancer into almost a chronic disease, especially the very advanced ovarian cancers, into diseases that, you know, wax and wane, and they need treatment and maintenance treatments, but that we're really prolonging overall survival.
Yeah, that's really inspiring message, really important for people to hear that message. And then just on a more practical note, you know, the medication, you know, patients often worry about cost of treatment and cost of medication. Is if a patient is, if they're recommended to take a PARP inhibitor by their oncologist, they might be worried about cost. Is it publicly funded, or how does that work?
Yeah, so all the PARP inhibitors for high-grade ovarian cancer, so as long as they're within the, I suppose, licensed indication, they are supported by the Department of Health and the NCCP. So that's all paid for. They don't cost the patients anything. They are expensive drugs, so that if patients wish to avail of them outside of a licensed or the approved and reimbursed indications, they do cost a lot of money. So they cost thousands a month for for these drugs. But that doesn't, for the standard indication, that doesn't fall on the patient at all.
Okay, okay. And that's all really useful information to know. And very, so it's a positive message around ovarian cancer messaging. Like you said, it's, you know, thinking of it for these patients more of a chronic disease management type situation.
Exactly.
Is there anything about PARP inhibitors that we haven't touched on before we talk to Jenny, who is a patient living with ovarian cancer? She's on a PARP inhibitor. Is there anything else you wanted to tell us about them?
So I suppose, just, they are intensive as regards their visits. So when you're on a PARP inhibitor, you do require bloods being taken monthly.
Okay.
And that often involves, certainly in the initial settings, coming back to your oncologist every month and having your bloods checked. And that's because the side effects of the PARP inhibitors, besides the nausea and the tiredness that I spoke about, can really impact on your blood counts. So patients can drop their hemoglobin or become anemic on PARP inhibitors, and occasionally even need a blood transfusion. White cell counts can drop, and platelets, which we need for making clots, they can actually drop in patients maybe at risk of bleeding or bruising. So these are really important to keep an eye on, and we do have to keep an eye on them for the duration that patients are on a PARP inhibitor, which can be quite intensive. Once patients are stable on the treatment, we can often do that, you know, in a more informal setting. So patients get their blood checked with their GP, and we can check them on the computer a few days later, and we don't have to be bringing people up and down. There are other side effects, including there is uncommon side effects, such as there is an impact on kidney and liver function at times. Again, the importance of the blood tests. Some patients might notice their blood pressure rises, or they have difficulty sleeping. And there are, I suppose, very rare things that can happen that are important, but can be are important for patients to be aware of. One of those would be you can get an inflammation of your lungs. Again, it's only about 1 in 100 people experience this. But just if anybody noticed a change in their breathing, just to seek medical attention. And occasionally we see an abnormality in the bone marrow, especially for patients who've been on PARP inhibitors for quite long periods of time. Again, just underlying the importance of getting that monthly blood check.
Okay, so it can be intensive at the start. Like, you have to link in with your oncology team in the hospital every month. But in time, as it becomes more predictable and, you know, you're established on a dose that's working for you, it can be stretched out over time and kind of more informal, if you like, with your maybe even at your with your practice nurse in time as things move on.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Thank you so much. That was so interesting. And I will move on to Jenny, who is a patient on PARP inhibitor.
Thanks very much, Tara.
Thanks, Dr. Collins. So now we're talking to Jenny, who is a mum of three. And Jenny was diagnosed with ovarian cancer, and Jenny is on a PARP inhibitor. Jenny, can I ask you, before you were diagnosed, around the time you were diagnosed, what did you know about ovarian cancer at that time? Did you know a lot, or had you heard much about it?
I was aware of it. I didn't know a lot about it, but I have a scientific background. So I sort of was very easily, it was very easy for me to be able to find the information out and understand the information.
Yes. Okay. So you're a pharmacologist, isn't that right?
Yes.
Okay. So you had the tools and the literacy to know where to go to inform yourself. But for a lot of people, that can be very difficult to know where to go to get more information. What would you advise to somebody in terms of making sure that they're getting the right information when looking for more information?
I think the most important thing is to go to your care team. When you're first diagnosed, you get a lot of information, a lot of leaflets, and you might not be ready to process and read through all those leaflets. I didn't. I put them under the bed initially. It was only later on that I went back and read through them. Your care team will give you the information that you want. So if you're the sort of person that likes to know everything, you tell them that and they will give you more information. If you're the sort of person that maybe just says, well, I just want to know the bare minimum, then just let them know and they will be led by you. I think also be wary of Googling, because there's a lot of information out there that is hard to understand or is maybe incorrect. But ask, if you're unsure whether the website you're reading is a reliable one, again, ask your care team. Very often the cancer charities have very good resources and links that you can read, and those are reliable sources.
Absolutely. It's so important to make sure what you're reading is from a reliable and up-to-date source. So you're on a medication, a PARP inhibitor, niraparib. Had you heard anything, or did you know anything about these medications before starting?
Yes, again, I guess I'm a little bit unusual in that because of myself and my husband, who's also a pharmacologist, he's actually been involved in some of the work with these PARP inhibitors. So we were fairly well informed and knew that they were a big game changer for those with ovarian cancer. And so were very keen for me to start on that treatment.
Okay, so you had that kind of that background inside knowledge and that you had already heard about the medication. Around the time you were diagnosed, Jenny, and going through treatment and, you know, thinking if others who are listening are going through similar, what did you find were good, helpful strategies to get you through that time? And maybe what were things that were unhelpful to you at that time?
Again, it's going back to using those resources that you're given and going back to your care team. I think using the charities or various resources where you can see podcasts of people that are living with cancer, or maybe you know somebody, a family member or a friend of a friend, talk to them about their experience and how they feel. You may gain information on the actual condition, but I think actually you'll get more help with how they dealt with it and what their feelings were. For example, at the end of my treatment, I actually felt worse than I did at the beginning because I felt lost. I felt that this protective bubble that I'd been in through my treatments had burst. And I wish I'd known that that feeling of being almost like being abandoned, being left alone, was actually quite a normal feeling for those that have gone through cancer and have finished the treatment. And it was only a few months later when I started talking to people, other people, that I realised what I was feeling was actually quite normal. So I would say, yes, use your care team, get the information from them, listen to podcasts, try and talk to other people that have been through the similar sort of treatment to what you are going through or what you're about to go through. It will definitely help and reassure you.
That's a really powerful, really important, and I think it's not very often said, Jenny, about the end of treatment or after. You know, at the start, it's very busy and there's a lot of tests and appointments and treatments, and you're very busy because you're going to all of these things and there's a lot of support around you and family and friends. But then after that, things become very quiet, and for a lot of people it might feel like it's over, but for you it's actually you're only just starting to begin to catch up and think about it. So at that point, if anybody's listening, that to recognize that loneliness, you don't have to feel lonely in that point. So to reach out to your care team or your cancer charity support networks for peer support, it's so helpful. Talking then about living with, life, say on this medication and after your treatment, do you have a new perspective now, or do you feel like you're a different person? Has your outlook changed?
Well, definitely, yes. I think I'm a lot more chilled. I'm less intent on proving myself to be super mom or super wife or super whatever, maybe. I suppose I'm trying to make use of every opportunity that life brings along to me now. Make more time for my friends, make more time for my family. And if my house is a little bit dusty, then so what? And if my kids don't get to do every conceivable activity, really doesn't matter. I'm also reaching out to a lot of friends that I haven't seen for a long time, because we kept sending each other the old email and said, yes, life's busy, you're doing this, doing that, and not really making any time. So in the last year, I've met up with quite a few friends that I haven't seen for a long, long time. And I think it made all of us stop and think, you know what, we should really make time for each other.
Yeah, that's so important. Making time for connection and friendships is so important for our health. Would you say you learned anything about yourself, do you think, going through this, Jenny?
I learned that I could cope with a lot more than I thought I could. And that's not because I'm brave or amazing. People might say, oh, you're being so brave, or you are doing such an amazing job. I don't see it like that. I'm doing it because I have to. I'm doing it for my family and I'm doing it for myself. But it has given me the courage and the knowledge in myself that strength is within, and you can deal with things what are thrown at you.
Yeah, that's very powerful to hear, you know, the courage within, you know, to go through it. And to keep going, like you said, for yourself and for your family. And did you learn, do you think you learned anything maybe about those around you, Jenny?
Yes, everybody reacts differently. And that kind of surprised me. When I didn't tell a lot of people initially. They kept it within very close family and friends while we were sort of going on with the first rounds of treatment. And everybody did react differently. And that, as I say, that took me by surprise. But once I accepted that everybody has a different need to cope with the situation, you make adjustments and you adapt, and then everybody is then ready to help each other.
That's really interesting. And again, another point I think that we don't hear a lot about is that, you know, when you're explaining your diagnosis or treatment to family or friends, that there are different reactions, and people can have different reactions at different stages as well. Some people might need more time as well to understand or to accept or to really hear what you're saying as well. So that's an interesting point to consider as well. So, Jenny, then just going back to where your journey started, the time you were diagnosed with ovarian cancer, can you tell us about your feelings around that time?
Yeah, sure. When I was diagnosed, I wasn't really, my symptoms weren't really very apparent, and I just put down to menopausal. It was only when I got very, very bloated that I went to the GP, and this fast forwarded onto appointments and scans and then the eventual diagnosis. So up to then, I was beginning to get an inkling, an idea of what was happening and that something was maybe a little bit more serious. Once I had the diagnosis, obviously I was quite shocked, but I went very much into the survival mode. I wanted to protect and support my husband, my children, my family, and everybody around me. Then your treatment plan always starts very quickly after your diagnosis. And so then I was into this protective bubble and going from appointment to appointment and treatment to treatment. And I don't think I really had time to think and process the information. It was only at the end of my treatment then I began to process it and think, what did my diagnosis mean to me? And what did it mean for my future? And that's when it became more difficult.
I think there's two very important messages there, Jenny. Like, firstly, you know, that the symptoms of ovarian cancer can be very vague, can't they? Like, you were maybe putting it down to menopause, and we hear so much about menopause now, you know, but it's important to go back to, you know, the BEAT acronym that we talked about earlier, you know, bloating, changes in eating, abdominal pain, or changes in bowel or bladder habit, and the importance of, you know, reaching out and asking for help at the start. It can be very, very busy, and there's all the appointments and the busyness at the start. But when the dust settles, then is when the time you might really need to reach out for that support. If you could give one message to somebody who has just been diagnosed, or somebody who is living with ovarian cancer, if you could give a message to them, what would you say?
I think it's important to keep those that you care about very close to you so you can help each other through it, is to keep a positive frame of mind, to know that your care team are doing the very best for you and that there's always work being done to improve the therapies, to improve the treatments for you, and to give yourself hope and to know that it's worth going through it all for yourself, for your family, and that it's worth keeping that smile on your face because there's always something to smile about.
Such an inspiring message, Jenny. Thank you so much for taking the time to share your story today. I know it's not easy, but it's very inspirational and will help people who are going through the same thing listening. So thank you so much, Jenny.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure to share my story with you all.
Thanks, Jenny.
Thank you for joining us today. For more information on gynecological oncology resources, please visit thisisgo.ie. This is a fantastic website for patients and their families that can be tailored to your own personal journey. It is important that all women are aware of the potential symptoms of gynecological cancers. These can include abnormal vaginal bleeding or discharge, feeling full too quickly, bloating or difficulty eating, pelvic pain or pressure, and even abdominal or back pain, a more frequent or urgent need to urinate, and constipation. Finally, itching, burning, pain or tenderness of the vulva, and changes in vulval colour or skin. If you have been experiencing any of these symptoms, please make an appointment to go see your healthcare provider.